Picture this. You're a founder, right? And not just any founder, but one with a genuinely good company.
Right, like the dream scenario.
Exactly. Your product actually works. You have real customers paying real money. And, you know, the market you're in is just undeniable.
You've been grinding for years.
Yeah. And finally, a serious institutional investor looks you in the eye and says yes. I mean, they want to lead your next round.
Cue the celebrations, right?
Well, hold on, because they send over this standard request list for your data room to kick off due diligence. So you hand over access to your folders.
Uh-oh. I know exactly where this is going.
Yep. 2 weeks later, the communication slows down, the tone changes, and suddenly the deal is dying.
It's the quiet killer of so many great ideas, honestly.
And it's not because your business model is flawed, you know, or your market is shrinking.
Right.
It's because your company just cannot answer for itself on paper.
A business can have like incredible momentum on the front end, but if the back office is just a chaotic mess, professional investors will absolutely walk away.
Yeah, they're not just buying a vision.
Exactly. They are buying the legal and financial reality of your corporate entity.
A great idea dying because of an unbuilt back office is it's a brutal reality check. So, welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Our mission today is to explore this highly detailed, incredibly focused source document. It's titled How an Investor-Grade Data Room Actually Gets Built.
It's a great piece.
We are looking at the meticulous and, you know, often totally underestimated process of preparing a company for ultimate institutional scrutiny. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's get.
Because reading through this material, building a data room isn't like stuffing all your messy clothes into a closet right before guests arrive.
No, definitely not.
It's much closer to passing a grueling structural home inspection. And the inspector isn't your buddy. Their full-time job is to find reasons to lower the house's asking price by 30% or just condemn the property entirely.
That structural inspection analogy, I mean, it gets right to the heart of the issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. The single biggest misconception out there, and we see this across the board with early stage companies, is that founders think a data room is just a shared drive.
Like a Dropbox link.
Exactly. They treat it like a Dropbox folder that you furiously populate the term sheet lands. But a truly investor-grade data room is the exact opposite of a weekend scramble.
So what does investor grade actually mean then?
In the industry, it hinges on three specific pillars. We call them the three C's: complete, coherent, and controlled.
Complete, coherent, controlled. In practice, how does that like actually manifest when an investor logs in? Let's start with complete.
So, complete means that for every single question an institutional investor could possibly ask, there is a specific verifiable document that answers it.
You aren't leaving them guessing.
Right, zero guesswork.
Yeah.
Then, coherent is about internal harmony across the business. And honestly, this is where most companies fail.
Oh, so.
Because every figure has to tie together flawlessly. If you state a revenue number in your annual report, it must equal the exact number in your accounting ledger, which must then equal the exact number authorized in your board resolutions. Nothing can contradict anything else.
Oh, wow. That is strict.
It is. And finally, controlled. This means the room is properly indexed, you know, version controlled, and features tiered access. It projects this image of a management team that has its act entirely together.
So we've established what this standard looks like from a bird's eye view, but I really want to get into the trenches here.
Yeah, let's dig in.
The source material points out that the scale of this undertaking is something founders badly underestimate. Like they think they're 80% of the way there
Right.
because they have a slick pitch deck.
A pitch deck and maybe a financial model in Excel.
Right. But when they actually face the institutional standard,
They usually discover they're closer to 30% ready, if that.
that is a massive gap.
It really is. It's this massive cross-functional undertaking that spans accounting, corporate governance, law, tax, intellectual property, investor relations.
It takes months to build properly.
Yeah, exactly. The source explicitly notes this lack of readiness is the most common reason a fundable company stalls in diligence.
See, if I'm a founder listening to this, my immediate thought is to just, you know, throw money at the problem.
Oh, sure. The classic fix.
Right. I have a company to run. Why can't I just hire a top-tier corporate lawyer for a weekend, lock them in a conference room with an espresso machine, and have them draft whatever is missing?
What's fascinating here is that a lawyer alone simply cannot solve this problem, no matter how much you pay them.
Wait, really? Why not?
Well, a lawyer can draft a contract, sure,
Yeah.
but a lawyer cannot reconcile your operational metrics to your accounting ledger and then tie that back to a tax filing. Right. They don't audit your software code for open source licenses, and they don't reconcile your payroll taxes.
So it's way beyond just legal paperwork.
Exactly. A legitimate investor-grade data room spans about 12 distinct professional work streams. And the critical challenge is that all 12 of these entirely different disciplines have to perfectly agree with each other.
Okay, so if a lawyer can't just paper over the gaps, what is the investor actually looking for across those 12 work streams?
It depends on the specific folder they're looking at.
Well, I imagine a lot of founders assume that as long as they haven't been sued, their corporate governance is fine. What is the diligence team actually testing when they open a folder labeled corporate and governance?
They're testing the fundamental reality of the entity. They're asking, like, is this a properly constituted company that legally authorized its own past actions?
So not just a piece of paper saying you exist.
No, they aren't just looking for a certificate of incorporation. They want statutory registers, capitalization records, board minutes.
Basically proving the company's directors formally approved major decisions at the time they happened, right?
Exactly. Not retroactively 3 years later. I mean, if the board didn't legally authorize a stock issuance, that stock might not legally exist.
Wow. Which, that actually brings us to a major pain point for a lot of growing companies, the cap table.
Oh, the cap table, yes.
I've talked to founders who have incredibly complex equity splits. You know, options pools, early employees who left, investors on different terms.
It gets messy fast.
Right. And I see the phrase fully diluted thrown around constantly in the source material. For anyone who hasn't raised capital before, what does that actually require proving?
So fully diluted means calculating ownership by counting every single promised share, even if those shares haven't vested yet or haven't been converted into common stock.
So no hiding behind future options.
Nope. No assuming someone won't exercise their rights. The test for this work stream is whether that fully diluted ownership matches the official share register exactly.
So a colorful pie chart isn't going to cut it?
Definitely not. Every single certificate, every transfer, every safe agreement, convertible note, founder vesting schedule, it all has to have a perfect paper trail tying back to the official legal register.
If you tell an investor someone owns 5% of the company, you need the historical documentation proving exactly how and when they acquired it.
Down to the penny and the exact date, yes.
Okay, let's pivot to the operational side, specifically the material contracts workstream.
This one is huge.
The source mentions that diligence teams are hunting for change of control landmines.
Yes.
Even if you aren't selling your company outright, realizing your biggest client can just walk away because you brought on a new partner, that seems like a massive operational blind spot.
It is a company-ending blind spot in some cases.
Company-ending.
Oh, yeah. A change of control landmine is a clause buried in a contract, often with a critical supplier or a flagship customer, that states, if the company's ownership changes by a certain percentage, the contract can be terminated or renegotiated.
So let's say you have a customer that represents 40% of your annual revenue.
Okay, perfect example. You sign a term sheet with a venture capital firm thinking you're about to scale.
Right.
During diligence, the VC's lawyers read that customer contract and realize the moment their investment clears, your biggest client has the legal right to rip up their contract.
Oh, man. So the deal blows up instantly.
Instantly. Because the revenue the investor thought they were buying just isn't secure.
That is a brutal scenario. And I imagine a similar logic applies to the IP and technology workstream.
Completely.
Like, what if a founder hired a freelance developer to build their core app 3 years ago, paid them in cash, and never had them sign anything?
Well, I assume you know the answer to that.
I assume the company doesn't actually own that code in the eyes of an investor.
You assume correctly. The diligence test here is entirely about clean title.
Clean title.
Yeah, you would be shocked how often a company's core software, its algorithms, or patents are accidentally sitting in the personal name of a founder or in the name of a contractor who is never required to sign a formal IP assignment agreement.
So from the investor's perspective, if the company entity does not cleanly own its intellectual property, they're buying an empty shell.
Worse. They are buying a future lawsuit from that contractor.
Yikes. Mm. Which perfectly bridges into the litigation and disputes workstream. The goal isn't necessarily to prove you've never had a disagreement, right? But to prove there are no hidden skeletons.
Exactly. You need a clean, non or disclosed letter.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, investors can price risk, but they cannot price unknown risk. They want every past dispute, every threatened lawsuit, regulatory inquiry, all of it fully documented.
And remember, we've only touched on a few of these 12 work streams. There's financials, tax compliance, HR, data privacy, insurance.
The breadth of this is exhausting.
Seriously.
But the depth, getting every single one of those 12 domains up to a standard where a hostile auditor can't find a flaw, is the true mountain founders have to climb.
Given that reality, and since we know a weekend binge with a lawyer won't work, what does the actual timeline look like?
Well, the source outlines a chronological 6-phase process for building this out.
Okay, let's go through them. Phase one is simply called diagnose.
Phase one is highly psychological. It's the deeply uncomfortable process of inventorying everything that currently exists and mapping it against the institutional standard we just discussed.
So this is where the founder, who felt they were mostly ready, sits in a room and watches a checklist fill up with red flags.
Exactly. They realize their board never formally passed resolutions for major hires. They realize their accounting is based on a bookkeeper's personal habits rather than standardized policies.
So getting phase one done doesn't mean you fixed anything. It just means you have an honest map of your own gaps.
Right, and a tangible plan to address them rather than operating on just like a general feeling of optimism. You have to know the exact dimensions of the hole before you can figure out how to climb out of it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. That transition into phase two is where the real work begins, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's called rebuild the foundation.
Yes, the heavy lifting.
My analogy for this is, it's like having to do forensic accounting on your own life.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you can't just write down on a piece of paper that you own a car. Mm-hmm. To pass this level of inspection, you have to go into your basement, dig through old boxes, find the original dealership receipt, produce the official state title, and locate the cleared check from your bank proving you actually paid for it.
That is the exact level of rigor required. Phase two is incredibly heavy lifting. You are reconstructing clean books from original source documents.
No more guessing.
No, you're pulling bank statements, actual vendor invoices, signed contracts. You cannot rely on a plausible-looking spreadsheet someone threw together for a board meeting last quarter.
So you're rebuilding the cap table share by share.
Yes. Tracing every issuance back to the bank ledger to prove the cash was actually received. You are standing up the formal governance skeleton so the company can legitimately authorize its actions going forward.
So by the time phase two is complete, your numbers finally reconcile across the board and the corporate narrative is historically accurate. Okay, so you've dug through the basement, you've found the receipts, and your history is accurate. But what if a contract simply doesn't exist?
Like your freelancer example?
Yeah, going back to that freelance developer. What if you realize you never got them to sign over the IP? How do you fill a historical gap from 3 years ago without, you know, committing fraud?
Well, that is the crux of phase three, which is draft what's missing. You absolutely do not forge documents to pretend things were handled correctly in the past.
Okay, good to clarify.
Instead, you legally draft the documents that bridge the gap today. So you track down that early contractor and execute a formal IP assignment deed, moving the ownership from them to the company in the present day.
Oh, I see.
You draft the core operational policies, you create a material contracts register, you formulate the financial model and the equity story.
So done looks like you have established clean title and a coherent narrative moving forward that an investor can actually underwrite.
Exactly. The past is fixed.
Right. At this point, the historical reality is accurate, legally sound, fully documented.
Mm.
But an investor's diligence team is essentially paid to destroy your valuation.
That's their job.
So how do we take this pristine historical record and present it to someone actively looking for flaws?
That brings us to phase four, curate and control. This is where you transform a massive, unwieldy pile of correct documents into a structured, navigable data room.
Meaning what, exactly?
It requires strict naming conventions, rigorous version control, so there is absolutely no ambiguity about which document is the final executed version.
Right.
You set up redaction protocols for commercially sensitive terms to protect your trade secrets. And critically, you establish tiered access.
Tiered access, like who gets to see what?
Exactly. A first look investor who just signed an NDA sees a heavily summarized version of the business. Only an investor who has submitted a series term sheet gets access to the granular confirmatory diligence materials.
The source also emphasizes setting up Q&A trackers and applying something called disclosure discipline. It specifically mentions a value versus capture split.
Yeah, that's a crucial concept.
Explain how that works in practice.
So disclosure discipline is about managing expectations and legal liability. A value versus capture split is a great example. Say you sign a master service agreement with a massive enterprise client.
Okay, sounds good so far.
The total potential value of that contract over 5 years could be $10 million. But you've only actually secured or captured $1 million in committed statements of work.
Ah, I see the trap.
Right. You must disclose that reality clearly. If you just put $10 million contract in your revenue projections and let the investor figure out the nuances later, you are destroying trust.
So phase four is about ensuring the room feels highly controlled, transparent, and disciplined, which sets the stage for phase five, mock diligence. I find this step fascinating. It's like hiring a professional penetration tester to break into your own corporate network, test the firewalls, and compromise your servers all before the actual malicious hackers show up.
It is exactly like a red team exercise. And it's the step almost everyone skips because they are exhausted by this point.
Yeah, I bet.
But it is the defining characteristic of a world-class data room. You run a generic institutional diligence checklist against your own room. You force your own team to chase down every detail.
So if an employment contract is missing a signature, you find it.
You find it. If a revenue figure in the model doesn't tie perfectly to the ledger, you halt and figure out why.
Because as the text points out, a gap you find and fix yourself is invisible.
Totally invisible.
But a gap the investor's legal team finds. That becomes leverage to negotiate a discount on your valuation. Or it causes them to lose faith and walk away entirely.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of deal making, phases four and five are incredibly powerful signaling mechanisms.
Signaling competence, right.
Exactly. A meticulously curated data room acts as a beacon of competence. When an investor's team walks into a room that is that dialed in, where every number ties and every risk is clearly disclosed, it fundamentally alters their perception of the founding team.
It signals that management runs a tight ship.
And investors absolutely price that competence into the valuation. They're willing to pay a premium for a company that proactively minimizes their risk of discovering unknown liabilities.
You're actively de-risking the investment just by demonstrating extreme organizational competence. That makes perfect sense.
It's the best ROI you can get.
And then we arrive at the final step, phase six, keep it live. Because after putting in hundreds of hours, a data room shouldn't just be a tomb where documents go to gather digital dust.
Exactly. It needs to be a living system.
Yeah.
It should be seamlessly fed by your monthly accounting close, your quarterly board meetings, and your regular reporting rhythm.
So it's always up to date.
The operational goal is that the room is never more than 30 days stale. That way, the company is perpetually ready to raise capital, enter into a strategic partnership, or even be acquired.
So the next time a major opportunity arises, it isn't a three-month fire drill where the whole executive team works past midnight.
You simply open the door and let them in.
Listening to all of this, my head is spinning. I mean, the sheer mountain of work required across these six phases and 12 work streams is just staggering.
It is a mountain, no doubt.
Which leads to the ultimate test the source mentions. When the investor opens the room, everything must tie. The annual report must equal the ledger, which equals the board resolution, which equals the signed contracts.
Flawlessly.
If I'm a solo founder or even running a lean executive team, I physically do not have the hours in the day to reconcile a dozen distinct disciplines perfectly.
The document is very clear on this reality. It is nearly impossible for a lean human team to produce this level of cross-disciplinary coherence under tight time pressure. Humans make rounding errors. Humans forget to upload the final countersigned version of a PDF. You are dealing with a dozen distinct professional languages, tax, legal, accounting, compliance, that all have to harmonize flawlessly.
So how does this actually get done today? The source outlines a modern solution that moves away from just throwing armies of junior analysts at the problem. It introduces the concept of the agentic back office.
This is where the mechanics of corporate management are fundamentally changing.
Tell me more about that.
An agentic back office is a supervised ecosystem of specialized AI agents. Unlike a generic chatbot where you just upload files and ask questions, these are purpose-built agents trained on specific disciplinary standards.
You have different agents for different jobs.
Exactly. You have one agent acting as the tax specialist, another as the corporate secretary, and another as the financial controller. But the crucial mechanism is how they interact under the supervision of an experienced human operator.
Explain how that actually works under the hood. How does an AI agent reconcile a ledger to a board resolution better than a human accountant?
It comes down to parallel processing and perfect recall. In a traditional setup, a human has to read a 20-page PDF of board minutes, note the authorized share count, log into the accounting software, pull the ledger, and manually compare the paid-in capital.
Which takes hours.
And an agentic back office does this simultaneously. The legal AI agent scans the executed board resolution and extracts the authorized parameters. It instantly pings the accounting API to verify the exact dollar amounts received in the ledger.
Wow.
It then cross-references the cap table software to ensure the shares were issued correctly.
All at the same time.
Yes. If there's a 1 cent discrepancy or a missing digital signature, the agents flag it immediately to the human operator to resolve. The AI is doing the relentless high-speed reconciliation that humans find exhausting.
So the human isn't replaced. They're just elevated from doing the grunt work of cross-referencing PDFs to orchestrating a highly capable digital team.
You become a true manager.
And the source provides concrete proof that this isn't just theoretical tech bro philosophy, right?
Yeah, correct. The approach has been empirically proven on a real regulated company operating out of the British Virgin Islands, which is a jurisdiction with stringent compliance requirements.
So they use this multi-agent system.
They use this exact multi-agent system to run their back office. The result is clean books, board resolutions that are legally e-signed and instantly filed into a proper digital minute book, a cap table that perfectly reconciles to the statutory register on a daily basis.
That's incredible.
And annual reports that meet award-winning standards. The technology is already executing at an institutional grade.
So what does this all mean for the people listening right now?
Well, the source identifies two specific groups who should be paying close attention.
Okay, who are they?
First, the ambitious pre-money founder who wants to organically be investable rather than just faking it until diligence exposes them.
Makes sense. And the second?
The owner of an established cash-flowing company that has real revenue but zero underlying process. The classic scenario where the founder is the central bottleneck preventing the business from scaling or being acquired.
Right. So for both of these scenarios, the core takeaway is really a paradigm shift. Building the data room is not the final agonizing chore you do before a sale. It should be the foundational architecture you build to scale your company.
The data room is the ultimate proving ground. It is where this agentic back office concept truly demonstrates its value, because building an investor-grade room is the most complex version of the corporate governance problem.
Because of all the moving parts.
Yes. You are forcing a dozen different highly technical disciplines to perfectly align. If you can solve the data room problem, you have effectively solved the entire back office.
Let's recap this journey. We started by dismantling the myth of the last-minute shared drive.
The dreaded Dropbox link.
Yeah, exactly. We explored the rigorous reality of the 12 work streams, from navigating fully diluted cap tables to diffusing change-of-control landmines.
Which is no small feat.
No. We walked through the pain of phase one's brittle diagnosis, the forensic accounting of phase two, and the strategic red teaming of phase five's mock diligence. And finally, we looked at how an AI-assisted agentic back office utilizes parallel processing to pass the ultimate test of total corporate coherence.
It represents a profound evolution in how resilient companies will be structured behind the scenes in the coming decade.
It really does. And to you listening, whether you are prepping to raise a massive Series A, or you're just trying to get the daily operations of your own small business out of your head and onto paper, this standard applies to you.
Absolutely.
Even if you never plan to sell, not knowing who owns your intellectual property or whether your contracts are secure is a ticking time bomb. Being investor grade isn't just a hurdle for Wall Street. It's a framework for anyone who wants to build a business that can survive contact with reality.
This raises an important question, one that isn't explicitly written in the source text, but serves as the natural conclusion to everything we've explored today.
Okay, let's hear it.
If a perfect data room requires your cap table, your accounting ledger, and your board resolutions to flawlessly reflect the operational reality of your business, does the relentless discipline required to build one force you to become a fundamentally sharper, more effective leader, even if you never end up taking a single dime of outside investor money?
That is an excellent frame of reference. Is the data room ultimately just a highly precise mirror reflecting your own leadership capabilities?
Exactly.
Well, we will leave you to ponder that. Thank you so much for joining us on today's deep dive. Just remember, the next time someone asks to look under the hood of your business, make sure the engine matches the paperwork. See you next time.